Okay, everyone.
We will begin with the Pledge of Allegiance. Can we have the roll call, please?
Yes, good evening, commissioners. Chair Greg Hartwig.
Present.
Vice Chair Marlene Hurd.
Present.
Commissioner Jani Castillo.
Present.
Commissioner Moses L. Main.
Excused.
Commissioner Barbara Montgomery.
Present.
Commissioner Adi Nagraj.
Present.
Commissioner Tanya Pitts.
Present.
Okay, moving to item number 3. Do we have a motion to approve the minutes of last meeting?
I'll approve those minutes.
I'll second.
Been motion seconded. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Abstentions? Noes? Okay, hearing none, carries unanimously. Old or unfinished business?
There is none.
There is none. So we will move to item 5. Are there any modifications to the agenda? Hearing none, we'll move on to item 6, which is new business, and item A.
Good evening, commissioners. Item 6A is a recognition. This past March, our cadets competed in a competition, a statewide competition, and they won some trophies, and we want to give them the trophies and recognize their efforts. Chief Carol Duplessis was not able to be here today, but Paul Malik, come on up, will be presenting in his stead, and maybe we can all just kind of get into the well for some of the pictures with the family and the youth if you want to walk around. Paul?
All of us?
Yeah, I think all of us if we want.
Okay. Yeah. All of us.
Okay. Good evening, commissioners.
Good evening.
Mr. Johnson, Mrs. Bell, directors, staff, and the public. It is with great pleasure that we are here today to recognize the accomplishments of our cadets and explorers. In the past 8 months, our cadets and explorers have attended 2 competitions, one in Paso Robles, California, and the other in Tulare, California. They went head-to-head with 40 other cadet and explorer programs that are more experienced than we have. We've got about 4 years on with ours. They participated in numerous police-based scenarios where they are critiqued on penal codes, officer safety, decision-making, and bearing. Having attended both competitions, our cadets and explorers have shown dramatic improvement in how assertive they were, the tactics they deployed, and the knowledge they possessed during each scenario. I would like to invite Cadet Explorer Coordinator Detective Ida Dupree to the stand to talk about more of the program.
So the first competition that we went to was in June of 2012. In this competition, the cadets and explorers participated with 42 other agencies. They did different scenarios ranging from domestic violence to an officer down scenario to a building search, and they tested their shooting skills. This competition goes within 3 days, and at the end of the event is a obstacle course. So the obstacle course begins with them sitting inside a patrol vehicle. They have to exit, zigzag through a course, jump a 4-foot fence, a 6-foot fence, do push-ups, and sprint. And in that competition, we actually brought home some trophies. Out of the 42 females that participated, our cadet, Perdomo, won 3rd place. And then the advisors weren't left out. So our male advisor, who attended that event, was Officer Souza. And I do have to admit, many of the advisors who participated were half his age, and he still brought home a trophy. So like Lieutenant Malik said, in March 2013, we went to our second one. There was about 34 agencies in that one. In that event, we were able to take six of our cadets and explorers along with us, and they worked hard. They did more scenarios different. They had an active shooting scenario. They had DUI. They had a suicide. They had a hostage negotiation. And they had to walk through it just like we do on the streets. I mean, it's no joke. They have to talk them down, convince them to put the weapons down, or convince them that everything's going to be all right and, you know, that the police are there to help them. And in other situations, they're fighting for their lives just like we do on the streets. The scenarios are just like we train when we go to the academies. And in this competition, actually, we brought home more trophies. Cadet Kim, she brought home first place in the female obstacle course, doing it on her own. She flew over that 6-foot wall. And Cadet Lee, his feet were going too fast for him that he couldn't keep up with his own feet, and he tripped over a cone. And even with the penalty of tripping over the cone, he still brought home third place.
Wow.
Yeah. But all this wouldn't be possible with the help that I get from the officers. There's officers who've been assigned that, you know, they're better in certain fields than others. And those officers have helped me train these cadets. And I mean, we were training 2-3 times a week for a long time to get them prepared. So without those officers from the Oakland Housing Authority, I couldn't have done it. And I really thank you guys, because they put their time in creating their own scenarios so the cadets can work through those scenarios just as if they were in the competition, because a lot of times they wouldn't tell you what the scenarios were going to be like. And of course, our chief participated and went to both competitions. And I have to tell you, he was the only chief other than the host agency chief to show up, and that showed a lot.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And obviously, you guys, commissioners and Mr. Johnson, I thank you guys for your support. Our cadets in our Explorer program has grown. And if you see, we have three new ones in the front seat. And you see how this program has changed them, their views on police department, and also the views of what they want to do in their future. And without your guys' support and helping us fund this program, it wouldn't be done. I really, truly thank you. And we're working. In 6 months, we got another competition going, and I invite you guys to come and be a part of it and see how it works. And I thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're not done yet. So with that note, I'd like to take this opportunity to speak about Detective Dupree and her outstanding strides she has made with the Cadet Explorer program. The Cadet Explorer program is not just an opportunity to develop their knowledge base of law enforcement, but it's an educational program that holds them accountable to their grades, their actions, and specific tasks that they are assigned. The kids have progressed from taking orders and doing tasks by the numbers to taking an active ownership of their duties within the police department. They're promoted to higher ranks based on their time and grade and their education and their grades. And so it is rare to find an individual that can mentor and mature these young adults as they're taking their first steps towards their careers. Detective Dupree has shown great leadership skills and among the cadets and explorers by setting the example and providing them guidance into achieving the goals that they set for themselves. The Cadet Explore program has been an astounding success, not only for the police department, but the community at large, because now our kids are setting the example for other kids to follow. So, and with that, on behalf of Chief DePlessis, it's my honor to present Detective Ida Dupree with the Chief's Accommodation Award.
Oh, wow, thank you.
Photo op?
Yeah, let's all come up and get photos first with Ida, if you want to come up. You guys want to come down or just I'll get this photo?
Thank you.
I need you two on the either end to just squeeze in, just, and Commissioner Montgomery and Ms., and Castillo, maybe if you...
Okay, right here.
Yeah, we can see you. Yeah, that's good, that's good.
Maybe holding something?
Yeah, if you want to put a couple of... No, somebody needs to hold them, can't see them. Wow, okay, thank you.
And we have photos of the competition for you guys. All right, thank you all. It's a wonderful program. It's our second year. I would just add that Officer Dupree, my congratulations for winning the Chief's Award. We know it's really coveted, and it's a real terrific accomplishment and testament to how outstandingly you perform every day and how nice and how gracious you are to everybody you come in contact with. Thank you.
Indeed, I would like to also congratulate everyone here, all of the cadets. I think this is really wonderful. I mean, this is seeing the world becoming a better place, because now we have, you know, we have young people that are really understanding what our police officers do, and I happen to think that they are very fortunate, because I believe that this is the best police department within, I mean, anywhere you could get to, driving in any reasonable period of time. So I thank you all again. This is really cool, this is really wonderful.
Thank you very much.
All right, moving on?
Oh, yes, moving on. Moving on to...
Thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you.
Moving on to new business, item B.
Item B is considering, it's consideration of a resolution approving the Housing Authority's comprehensive budget, which includes public housing program AMP budget, staffing plan, and fiscal year ending June 30, 2014, and HUD certification documents. So this is a challenging budget year for everybody around the Bay Area, as you've heard, but certainly for us, because of some of the significant changes to the budget that have occurred on a federal level due to sequestration, but even prior to that. And the proposed language that is in the President's budget related to some changes in the way that they're going to fund MTW agencies. So in order for me to get it right, I'm going to rely on a PowerPoint presentation that we worked on for the past couple of weeks with the Budget Committee. So if we can pull that up, Julie, that'd be great. And I'm going to walk you through this, and then we'll walk you through the larger budget and get some questions. So to talk about how the President's budget impacts this budget, the President proposes a federal budget. Congress is ignoring it at this point. People are saying it's, you know, dead on arrival, but that doesn't mean that there aren't provisions that will just carry forward. The reasons that it's considered dead on arrival are not our reasons. The language in it, which is what I put in the slide, is what I wanted you all to really be aware of, so when you have conversations with people about how that language impacts us, you can be more specific and go back and look at this board packet and get them the direct information. But in previous years, HUD has always prorated MTW's funding, so we're at the same proration as all the normal housing authorities. So if they fund the Section 8 program at 83%, we get 83% of our HAP. their historically low funding levels since 2012. The last appropriations bill was in 2012. Since then, we've been operating off continuing resolutions. The next continuing resolution is through September 30th of 2013, and then it expires. So they've started preparing themselves to do a 2014 budget, and that's where the president's language comes in. In HUD's proposed budget, which is the president's budget, he proposes that in determining the calendar year 2014 funding allocations for MTW agencies, HUD may also take into account anticipated impact of proposed changes to income targeting, medical expenses, and any other utility allowances. Any savings that we have, he could sweep. So if we propose to do something around triannual inspections and garner this much savings, then what they're saying is, I want to go in and sweep that back to the federal government. Okay, it's a very important change, because in the past we've been able to use that to do things like build Harrison Tower next door. So move on. HUD's fiscal 2014 budget proposes a significant legislative change that would supersede existing MTW agencies' 10-year contract agreements by allowing HUD to offset MTW PWA's excess housing assistance payment reserves as determined by the department. This means that HUD would be able to offset MTW's housing assistance reserves for housing choice vouchers within the 10-year contract agreement. And again, it's if we don't use the HAP for HAP, then rather than we have our MTW costs that we pull out of that system, what this is saying is at the discretion of the Secretary of HUD, he can go in again and sweep those. Now, those are really important funds for us because they fund things like our local program for sponsor-based, which funds Abode and First Place to go in and actually provide housing for people who are chronically homeless, formerly incarcerated, and emancipated foster youth, because those don't count in their system. In our contracts, it's perfectly legal and correct to do it the way we're doing it. And HUD is trying to amend our contracts through the appropriation language in this bill. Fiscal year 2014 budget proposes to combine direct appropriations with offsets of PHA's excess HAP reserves for everyone, if needed, to prevent termination of rental assistance for families as a result of insufficient funding and to avoid or reduce a downward proration for HAP revenues. The proposed statutory language in HUD's fiscal year 2014 budget does not define the level of excess HAP reserves or subject to offset. Instead, it just leaves it up to the complete discretion of the Secretary. These are sort of earth-shattering things to put in an appropriation bill. That's why I want you to be aware of them. The next slide. So sequestration cuts alone, if that language carries forward, it could be very damaging to us and a lot of other agencies and all the MTW agencies, but even other agencies. So there is going to be a push to not have that language carry forward. I've already met with a lot of our elected officials in their offices when I was back in D.C. with this language, with these concerns, so that if the language does end up in a House bill or a Senate side bill, it can be hopefully be dealt with. But there's no guarantees. It's a very bleak conversation with anyone in D.C. Through sequestration alone, the income lost to this agency is going to be $9.1 million per year, and that equates to anywhere from 800 to 900 families. And the reason we're saying 800 and 900 families and not saying 849 or 872 is the way the Section 8 program works, and the way that if they do some other changes it will work more in the new language will, is they give us the HAP money, and then we serve as many people as we possibly can. So if we have a lot of families who have very shallow subsidies amounts that we're paying, then we can serve more families. If we have families that require more subsidy every month, then we're serving fewer families. So we're giving a range because part of the language is, rather than say 11,129 families is our maximum for a regular housing authority, some of the proposed changes are to say, here's your HAP amount, serve as many people as possible, which I think is a much better way to administrate the program in general. The freeze on issuing vouchers, which is currently in effect, we project out will last at least through 2016, and we're going to show you some slides on how we get to that figure. We have, at this point, prior to freezing the list, finished issuing vouchers to 328 veterans that are on our wait list. They have the highest priority for our wait list, and we thought it was essential that we get those out if we're going to freeze the wait list for 3 years. So all of the vouchers in Oakland that we have on our Housing Choice voucher wait list are being served. And these are not the VASH vouchers, Veterans Assistance for the Chronically Homeless. These are just veterans on our wait list. In addition to that, we have the VASH program. So we have 207 VASH vouchers, if I remember correctly, Michelle. I think it's 205. And we just got awarded 60 more. So we will have an additional 60 this year for the chronically homeless veterans services as well. Next slide. But that doesn't mean it's all bleak and bad news. You know, I was trying to say, how do you present a budget in a way that says, what does it do? And how can I sell you that this is the best approach and the best budget? And these are what we came up with. So it's been bantered around. And I think they're all truthful. And I think that these are things that I don't know in other single housing authority in really California can say the things we're just going to say now. We're going to continue to provide subsidy. Some of them will do some of these, but all of them, I don't think so. Continue to provide subsidy to all currently housed families in our programs. Although we're freezing admissions to the tenant-based program and the MTW local program. So we're not planning to cut any households who are currently subsidized, period, because I just don't think we can do that. On a personal side note, I know that if we would just say, okay, we got to cut 800 families, here's your cut notices, let them all picket and make noise, we might, similar to the Transportation Authority, get some funding right away because the flights were delayed. But these are real people with real children in real houses in real homes in Oakland, and it's just not the way we can morally behave. And preserving our current assistance is needed. And when I was actually in D.C. when they were debating the whole aviation thing that week, and it was appalling. You know, they knew the timing. I shouldn't have been quiet about it. Sorry. It was just really appalling that they would take one slice of sequestration that inconvenienced certain legislators and correct it in literally 24 hours, and that they can't correct 125,000 homeless people that are going to be created through sequestration, the WIC program, which is dying on the vine, every after-school program, particularly, you know, Head Start, yeah. Head Start, which is drastically cut, really is kind of an appalling thing. But we're also, the next thing we're trying to do is avoid any layoffs and furloughs for OHA employees. So a lot of other agencies, as you know, have gone through and are going through both layoff and furloughs, and we're trying desperately not to have to do that by being really cautious with what we're doing and what we have and our assets that we currently have. We want to honor 329 project-based Section 8 voucher award commitments that we have made that are coming offline. It's a lot of units. And that's just part of it, but it's actually a lot higher figure if you take it out over the next year, which we do in our slides. But we need to keep those in place. Those are a contract and commitments we've made. They're development agreements in place, and they're going to be resources, very precious resources for affordable housing that people can apply for. We want to maintain police services department staffing levels, and we want to continue to provide funding for family and community partnerships initiatives. I don't want to abolish those initiatives just because we have two-year cash flows issues that are facing us. We want to continue to invest in our OPI project-based Section 8 unit restoration project. So we're going to continue to try and work through those units, maybe not as rapidly as we had initially planned for the next 12 months, but then maybe in 2015 a little more rapidly and hopefully finishing up, you know, 2016, 2017. So that's an ongoing annual number of units that we really want to comprehensive remodel and get another good 20, 30 years life out of them. So it's a wise investment for us, and there's some options for us in terms of overleasing, in terms of that property as well, to serve more families. We want to continue to invest in our business system upgrade. That's been really something that has been dogging this agency for years, and we need to correct it. We want to continue to invest in our Webster Street next door. That'll provide, I think, a more habitable space to work and a more pleasant place for our clients to come. So those are the things that we're trying to get accomplished in the next 12 months. Now I'll give you some overviews of where we are in terms of our subsidy over time. And this is the operating subsidy. Operating subsidy is for public housing. And we just went back to 2010. We could have gone back farther and shown you more, but I think it's just more recent knowledge of where we were and where we are. So you can see a significant drop. Some of that, you know, a $5 million drop in funding for the public housing program. And I think it's a testament to Congress's complete disregard for the program. Next slide. This is the capital fund program, which coincides with the public housing program. So our capital fund monies, if you can see, have gone from 9 million to just over, you know, to 6.6 over 3 years. Again, a testament to the fact that they just don't believe in the program, so they cut it every year. Next. This is a little deceiving because this is our Section 8 program. Our Section 8 program has grown between 2011, 12, and 13, if you look at that. So we gave you the voucher count and the subsidy amount. And the voucher increase between, for example, 2012 and 2013 constitutes about 100 vouchers The 100 vouchers were Westlake Terrace converted, and so we got offered new vouchers from HUD to subsidize that property, so we did that. And then we got 50 additional VASH vouchers. So that was money that they've added in the face of this, which I think is a testament to when Secretary Donovan says he wants to move the platform so everyone's on Section 8 through RAD or other means. This is kind of what he's talking about. This funding has been approved, and this funding was higher than was going up where the rest were going down, the number of people they were serving. The next slide. The reserve balance. The reserve balance is how much money we keep to write checks for development and other activities, and how much we have in unobligated assets that we can operate on a cash flow. So you can see the up and down. We're going to write some really big checks in 2013 that's going to bring that down by the beginning of 2014, and we're going to show you each quarter for the next three quarters what we're writing on the next slide. So this is a voucher analysis of our leach up schedule, and we extended it through 2016 because I wanted to see how long it would take us to get right-sized through attrition. So if we can't serve that number of families with that number of dollars, how long with just letting people graduate off the program will it take? There's some presumptions here, and I'll walk through column by column. The new external project-based voucher, which is the first column. So by the end of 2014, we're going to have 139 of those that we think are going to be leased up, ready for leasing anyway. And by the end of 2015, we have an additional 288. So it's a significant investment in the project-based portfolio. The new OP project-based units, we're going to have 100 a year that we want to plan to do. So we'll rehab 100 units a year and put them on the program. The total project-based vouchers, so these are the ones we're project-basing. Right now, 1,278. And by the end of 2016, that number goes up to 2,005 project-based vouchers. So a big increase. Although our wait list for the TenantPace program is going to be closed during this period until we can get our leasing under control, those sites will have project-based wait lists open, so there will be some access for people to get housing. Now I want to talk to you about the tenant-based vouchers, which is the one program that is the one that we can do something about in terms of right-sizing and how we can cut. At the end of 2013, we're going to have 10,776 people on the tenant-based program, and by the end of 2016, that will have dropped to 9,669 families. So it's a significant drop. What we know in terms of the drop, the attrition, is that our attrition rate, we're projecting at about 30 families a year. When I first started at OHA, it was 70, 75 families a year. A couple years ago, it dropped to 50. A month. And then a couple years ago, it dropped to 50, and now it's down to 30. So we're just going to assume that no one's going to leave our program, and we're going to stay at 30 because that's what it's been. And that equals about 360 families a year that we get the vouchers back and we go down to. So if you look at the right column, you see the total number of vouchers. We have 12,054 now. By the end of 2016, we'll have 11,701. Next slide. So here's the gradual decline of the tenant-based program at 30 a month, just averaging 30 a month between now and 2016. The next slide. And here's the gradual increase of the tenant-based or the project-based vouchers, where we creep up from, you know, over 1,200 to the final total of 2,005. Next slide. So if you put them together, what you see is a gradual decline of the tenant-based program and a gradual decline increase and then decline of the overall program. The blue still represents the tenant-based portion that's going down by 30 a month. The red is what remains in the project-based. And if you can see, there's a peak in January 2015. And then it goes down and corrects itself. Next slide. These are the projects that are coming off and when they're expected to lease up, and a graph to the left that shows you the peak in January 2015, where we have the most number of units coming offline, and OP is pretty consistent. So assuming all these sites go forward with the anticipated lease update, then we wouldn't expect to be right-sized in the agency until the end of 2016. And that's also assuming that the funding levels from HUD stay the same. The funding level could go up. We'll be in much better shape. Hopefully it won't go down. So that's kind of the analysis of on our income side, what's impacting us and how we have to make the adjustments. We have a couple of slides that we've done for some of our expenditures, and particularly payroll expenditures, to kind of walk through some of the things that we've done in the past 2 years and see how they look and how they impact us. So we have overall payroll expenditures. We have, if you see in 2011, it was just over $25 million, and then it peaked up in 2012 and then went down in 2013. If you remember, in 2012, we had to pay retroactive COLAs to everybody, so it skews your chart. Otherwise, it probably would have been a much gradual step up if we could have gone back. If you look at the benefits as well, we had the 2011 benefits. They went up in 2012 and then down in 2013. The down in 2013 has as much to do with vacant positions that we haven't filled as anything, so you know. The other thing we did do in September of this past fiscal year, right after the fiscal year we had the roll-up, is we did make whole the retirement benefits to CalPERS, so we paid $9 million into that fund for our employees, which kept their retirement whole. And we're going to get another assessment in the next couple of years, but that act of paying $9 million of shortfall to their retirement benefits keep all of our current employees and retired employees whole in the retirement system. So when you hear people projecting CalPERS has this deficit, we have made payments into that deficit so that our employees are taken care of. And that was it's a very comfortable and nice thing that we're able to do that, and we'll see what the new assessment says now that we've done it. Next slide. And we separated that out because if you put it on top, it skews the data completely. The salaries, 2011, 2012, and 2013, again, this is based on bargaining unit, you know, going back 2-3 years of payments and what it does to the budget. And part of the reason we want to have COLAs every year is so that we can map every year and you don't kind of get these bumps. In the benefit package, what I wanted to show you is you have the same sort of arc, you know, down, up, and down, because we did all of the retro COLAs in 2012. And that extra money is something that HUD is not going to have available for us, we feel, going forward. So that's our nervousness with trying to get the COLAs done in real time every year so that we can draw them down in real time. Had we held on to this, it may be the month we were trying to make everybody whole that we were doing it that year. Those funds might no longer be available to HUD under the new language I showed you at the beginning of the slides. The light green section that is layered on top, those are our OPEB, which is actually our post-retirement medical benefit payments. So we've made two payments. We made one in 2011, one in 2012. We have not made a payment in 2013, but it was 3.3 and 4.3 that we paid down so far, and we have three more payments to go. Next slide.
I just wonder, Eric, is it possible to prepay?
That's what we're doing.
Yeah, okay, right.
But we're doing it. Our total amount is 20. Do you remember 24? Yeah, and it started at 20, and we paid it down twice. So, and the sooner we pay it down, the better off we are because of the actuarials that make it, you know, a shorter, lesser amount. So the pension expenditures for us have actually gone down a little bit, again, because of positions that we have been judiciously not filling. And then in 2013, we have the special payment we made, which was the $9 million. And unless you can take that out, it doesn't look accurate. So we took that out so you could see where we're headed. Next. So temporary employees. Temporary employees we only went back to 2011. We could have probably gone back farther, but I don't know that anybody thought there was any much value in it. But what we've done with temporary employees, if you remember, we had a large number of temporary employees in this agency for a period of time. And we had large temporary employment contracts. And we haven't been to the board for a temporary contract since the last time you did it was in January of 2010, before I was ED. And you did a contract for temporary employment. One of the things we took on was to try and reduce that number. So we started at 64 in early 2011, and we've got it down to 26, and then it actually now is 27 because we have a temporary in the executive office backfilling for Julie Christensen's position because she's been promoted. I'm happy to announce. Yes, you can applaud. And Inez, by the way, is on vacation, so Julie agreed to work through with us up in executive until we get through today's meeting, and I appreciate it. The other ones are all people who are out on long-term disability medical out of the, you know, backfilling existing people. So we have 26 that are just backfilling people out on leave. Next slide. Development expenditures, and this is where we get into how much money is going out the door when and on what projects. And I know it's been, you know, we've had lengthy conversations about our development list and the table. And I think what Tracy and Janet have given us this year is really more illustrative than anything. And Anna Gwen worked on the tables, if she's here, that really kind of illustrate it. Thank you. That can show us where the money is going each year. So fiscal year 2013, this quarter, the quarter we're currently in, you can see we're going to spend $8,402,033 on development activities. In the first quarter of 2014, meaning between July 1st and September 30th, we're going to spend $9.6 million in development costs. And the last quarter of the second quarter of the calendar year, before December 31st, it's going to be just over $8 million. And those are all things that we have committed. Some of them come from replacement housing factor funds, which are funds that need to be used only for that purpose. But they're the decisions that we've made in the past few years with our development projects, and that total $26 million worth of real estate development investment in the next 9 months that this board's making with this budget. So when you review the whole budget, keep that in mind, that $26 million of that is going to be investment into these projects. In terms of our cost containment strategies, some of the things we've done because we've had such a challenging couple of years is we tried to reduce staff costs, but we wanted to do it judiciously. So those positions that really were non-essential or weren't meeting some of the core income areas, we delayed hiring, and we're going to propose probably to continue delay hiring some of the positions that are in the budget through the first few months of the fiscal year to see what the federal budget does, because we want to know our financial position before we take on some different initiatives. So it'll be very judicious, but we're going to try and hold what we can hold until we see where our money is. We reduced the number of temporary positions to the point where our temporary positions are only used till we backfill for a short period of time, or for people out on long-term disabilities or or other leaves. And then we've deferred two payments. Our fiscal year 2013 and our fiscal year 2014, we were scheduled to make two payments totaling $9.3 million into our post-retirement medical benefits unfunded liability. We are proposing not to make those in the next 2 years and postpone those until the following 2 years. If the federal funding happens and our cash flow allows it, then we might change that. But right now, after a lot of review from finance and discussions with Janet and I, we thought that the two things that would probably benefit it gets through this cash flow issue of writing $26 million worth of development checks on one side, and on the other side getting cut with our funding, would be to postpone making those for 2 years. To put it in context, we are somewhat heroic for having made two already. I think that even the city of Oakland is not going to submit their plan on how they're going to pay it down till 2016 or 17. Our goal is to get it paid down as quickly as possible because it lowers the number. It saves us money to pay it. But the cash flow of the agency does not allow us to do it. So we're recommending holding that. And we'll revisit next year if we can somehow sneak it in. But right now we're postponing that. And we're postponing any capital improvements, purchases whenever possible. We've frozen hiring any of the vehicles next year. The police department has made some cuts to their operating budget that won't impact the number of officers in the street, but other things they wanted to do, they're going to hold off. And right now, we're putting no funding or allocation, or cost of living agreements or anything that are under negotiation with the bargaining agreements. If we get agreement, then we will need to identify where the reserves are coming from, and we'll look at our cash flow and where those savings can come from. So that would come part as the package. So this time, if we do approval with negotiations, it will come with also to amend the budget to include and identify where the funds are coming from. Next slide. The cost containment, things that we could do to try and get us corrected financially quicker, because the quicker we can get our leasing down or our costs down, the better off we are. We can suspend making new project-based Section 8 awards and reevaluate any renewal requests. Now, the challenge with that is it doesn't really help us. But I'm just list these are in no order, just some choices we have. Because most project-based Section 8 awards you're going to make aren't going to come offline quick enough to have an impact on our cash flow. And by the time they come offline, we're going to be corrected. So we're really not helping anything. We're just delaying a project unnecessarily, I think. We have a project-based Section 8 award, for example, on the agenda later tonight. And I on the consent calendar that I could come up with no reason not to award, because by the time they need their vouchers, we're going to have them. You know, we just made a choice and put a lot into development that are coming offline at the very time we hit sequestration. Postpone any new affordable housing activity and investment. I think that's kind of the no-brainer unless we come up with more money. We just don't have the money for investment anymore, at least until we can get our cash flow going. And then it's going to take a couple of years of working to build our reserves up again. restrict or eliminate portability of the Housing Choice Voucher Program. This one is primarily an administrative burden of all agencies administering it, and it would save us money on that regard. But the other thing I would tell you is it could encourage attrition. So its other unwritten context is if someone wants to leave Oakland and go to West Virginia and take our voucher with them, we would say no, unless that agency was going to absorb them, pay for it. There are ways we could stop that under MTW and not have to write checks. We have about 1,300 families that are not living in Oakland that we are paying for. 1,300, which is roughly 10% of our program. And this is a way under MTW we can consider closing that door. And we're going to look at that. Michelle's already doing some stuff, and it means some changes we're going to have to work with Annaguen, because I think it may take an MTW change. So it's a significant amount of work to get there. But I think in the long run, it would be good to get there. It limits choice, but it also, I think, invests in Oakland. So we'll have that debate when we bring the item forward. But we're talking about it. Rent a portion of OPI units without project-based Section 8 vouchers at rent levels that are affordable to 50 to 60% AMI families. So we have 1,554 units. If you looked on our table of project-based voucher units, we're projecting 100 vouchers going on those a year. If we were even to take 300 of those units and say, we're going to rent these to this income range at this rent level but not use a Section 8 voucher, we will save money and we'll house more people, because the tenant-based voucher will still be being used over here in the private market, but we will have a different range of income for some of the units, because a very low-income family won't be able to afford that unit, but they will be being housed on the tenant voucher side, and it's a way we can serve more people with different incomes. So we're looking at that. That, again, is no quick change. It takes a change to the admission policies and a wait list and everything else. It's not a quick fix. It is something I think that could benefit us in the long run very much. We can serve the same number of very low-income households that we always have and increase the medium range without using a Section 8 voucher to do it. The next one, reduce significantly or eliminate entirely the utility allowance adjustments for tenants. The annual cost of our utility adjustments that we provide through the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program is about $9.3 million a year worth of adjustments. It's a lot of money. The problem with it is if we get rid of the utility adjustments, then the tenants have to pay the utility themselves. It increases their burden. So it's kind of like raising their rent for the utility because they get a credit. It is something they have some control over, though. They can try and use less of their utilities and try and not use. I mean, mine are very low. They make fun of me because my office is always cold. I never have the heat on. I have the windows open all the time. My utility bills are literally probably a third to a quarter of what we provide in adjustments on average. We probably provide about 60 some odd. Yeah. Dollars a month for utilities. My utility bill literally is $19 a month, $20 a month. So anyway, that's my disconnect. But the other thing I'm going to tell you is that if you remember back in the original slide, what HUD said is if you can find a cheaper way to do it or you change any of these things, then we can go in and recapture it. So it may be we're just going to give the money to HUD, at which point we're not going to do it. We would rather subsidize the folks.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. And we can modify Section 8 payment standards to reduce housing assistance payments per family to serve the same number at a lower cost to OHA, but at a higher burden to the family. This is what the Santa Clara Housing Authority did. They're trying to change the voucher payment standard to 35%. So your rent's calculated at 35%. Remember, we're at 28%. But we're approved to do the demo for, yeah, and get rid of the medical stuff. So that's what, and that choice is, you know, Jerry Garcia once said, quoting the prophet Jerry, that, you know, a choice between the lesser of two evils is still choosing evil. And that's sort of the dialogue that I feel like I've been having around this budget for the past month. And that's one of the evils. Next slide. Oh, we're done. All right, so moving on to the table. I first want to just send my grateful thanks and compliments to the finance department, Tracy, Janet, and Carolina Bartlett, who put together the most comprehensive table you have ever seen on the operating budget of this authority. And I will turn it over to her to talk a little bit about. Thank you, Janet.
Good evening, Commissioners. Janet Rise, Deputy Executive Director. You have in front of you a consolidated annual operating budget for the authority. I will just point out a couple of areas. I want to first of all say this operating budget includes two of our blended component unit organizations, CAHI and OPI. We are not asking you to approve those budgets because they will be submitted to those respective governing bodies in June. But we do need to include them in the overall picture because there is funding that comes from both of those entities that impact this budget. So just going through each column, we've shown you here our central office costs, which is column D, which is our executive office, finance department, IT, contract compliance, and general services. Our column E is made up of OHAPD and Office of Real Estate Development. Column F is our capital fund program. We showed you an earlier slide of how our capital fund dollars have declined. This is a reflection of those expenses. Both revenue is the first page is primarily revenue, and the subsequent pages are all of the expenses. Column G is our Family and Community Partnerships Department. And that is funded primarily through several different funding sources. We have our Family Self-Sufficiency Grants funding that program, our ROS grants, or Resident Opportunities for Self-Sufficiency, and our Leased Housing Department also supplements the revenue there. Column H and I represents property management and the asset management department, and those are part of our public housing operating budget dollars. Column J is the capital improvements division, Mr. Bailey, and they do a substantial amount of work on behalf of OPI. So the $7 million that you see in the OPI column, $7.3 million, is the fee for service that we charge OPI for all of the work that our capital improvements division does. Column K is our AMPS. These are our public housing AMPS. It includes revenue from the sale of five properties that we sold to CAHI. So there you see about three quarters of the way down top page is about $2.9 million of the $3 million in revenue. Other revenue comes from the sale of those properties. And so that will go to support our public housing properties and the work and the expenses that are associated there. Column L is our leased housing department. Again, reflecting the effects of sequestration on the revenue, and then going down in just general operating expenses. The next column is called Leased Housing Non-MTW. That is where our boutique vouchers are paid for, funded, and then expenses associated. That's our Mainstream, our Shelter Plus Care program, single room occupancy, our VASH, and our non-elderly disabled vouchers.
And those are non-MTW vouchers, and they have to be discreet, and we have no fungibility with them.
And that's also our Family Unification Program, or FUP. And then again, column M is representative CAHI. The majority of the dollars that you see there are housing assistance payments to our private landlords. As you all are aware, CAHI, in partnership with CGI, administers programs throughout Northern California. Column N is representative of our local program dollars. Those are our developer fee dollars as well as our ground lease dollars that are coming, anticipated to come in 2014. Total non-federal money. The local program is all non-federal money, and it is comprised of developer fee money that we earn as being a part of some of the development deals and field shop. We also have several ground lease provisions, so the ground lease dollars go in this column as well. Mm-hmm.
Through the chair. Just one quick question, Janet. Since they're non-federal monies, that means they can't be recaptured, right? Because those were ones that were potentially able to be recaptured?
That is correct. They're in
excellent
a separate bank account.
That was one of my questions.
Yes. And then finally, column O represents OPI. And again, we just bring this to your attention because much of our CID fee-for-service dollars, they actually go to support our OPI program, our entity. OPI also has, again, we are collecting fair market rents similar to our housing assistance payments there. So that's another revenue stream that comes in rather than having it funded through operating subsidy or some other source. And with that, that gives you an overview of the individual columns. And then again, the first half of the first page of the spreadsheet is all of the revenue that comes in, and every other subsequent page represents the expenditures. I will take any questions.
And the other thing I would tell you that, and Jenna can go over just kind of the last page of our final bottom line, and if there's any question or detail you want on any specific line item, we're all happy to meet with you, talk to you about it, and there's a binder that correlates to this. If you want to know more, please let us know. We know most of it, but I don't know that the binder's this thick, and I may have to look up what a cost is, but if we go over just kind of the final total expenses,
sure,
and where we are and where it leaves us at the end of the year.
So on the last page, which is page 5, you see at the very bottom, we identify our total expenses, our excess revenue over expenses, and then our total capital fund expenditures. So you have to look across, because each area, there are some areas that are in the positive, which means they have excess cash flow, and other areas that you see are in a deficit. And so really what this chart represents is if you go over to the first column, which says total, that ultimately is where we are going to end. We anticipate ending in 2014, given where we are right now.
And so if you look at the $20 million deficit, that includes $17 million invested, you know, in different capital improvement activities, construct, fill shop, and a $3.1 million operating deficit, which we hope doesn't grow based on cuts that HUD could make. The challenge for us in this whole budget is really one of cash flow this year. It's when we have to write checks, do we have enough revenue to do that and still have a safe harbor for operating reserves? Because we are dangerously close to going below the threshold of what HUD would consider to be a safe operating reserve if we were to write everything right now. So that's where Jenna and Tracy have been mapping out where we are in terms of writing the checks and making sure we have the dates correct from Phil's shop and make sure that we can draw down again the money from HUD to keep our operations going. So operating reserves are really what the challenge of the budget is. Once we get through the beginning of 2015 and we have the big project-based units coming offline and we're funding that as well, once we get over that hump, I think we get much better off right away. But the cash flow, writing the $26 million worth of development costs in the next 9 months, is really a challenge. Do you want to add anything about that?
No, I think that I'll just take any questions that you have.
Yeah. So then we have the next table real quickly is just our staffing. We're proposing level staffing, but again, there's been a couple shifts. Executive office absorbed the legal staff from OPO, so we actually have legal in executive, as well as the executive director, deputy executive director and executive. So there's some of that shifts. Otherwise, it's a flat statement. And I think that's it. We're ready for any questions.
When I looked at this, I liked it because it has everything outlined. Mm-hmm. It really helped me a lot in dissecting it.
Okay.
Regarding the fraud recovery,
$800,000?
Mm-hmm. The chief's not here to explain what a good job he does, so I'll do it for him.
Right.
Fraud recovery is through our, we invested in adding some resources to our police department for Section 8 fraud recovery. The recovery language currently reads that we get 50 cents on the dollar.
50 cents, okay.
And there's been a push to try and change that with HUD to say we want 100% of our fraud recovery because we'll just reinvest it in more subsidized housing should we get it. But the chief's been very successful.
Okay. And my other question, and it's only a recommendation, getting footnotes at the bottom of this, if possible.
Okay.
If possible.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Thank you.
I had a question. The budget that's on page 2 of the memo, I think that's just for public housing, if I'm reading it right. And it shows us operating at a deficit of $24.9 million there and $20 million here, which I'm assuming we're recouping that $4 million somewhere else. I'm trying to reconcile the two budgets and understand the difference.
Okay, so you're correct in that the budget on page 2 of the summary document includes capital fund and public housing. The larger budget has OPI, has CAHI, has public housing, has MTW, everything. And so we needed to show you the full picture because that we have funding that's coming into the other areas. However, when you, if you just extract public housing, it looks worse.
It's pretty bad.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so where is the funding recouping from there? What categories are we taking it out of? What other?
So if you'll notice for the $24 million, so for instance, Fund 1, Fund 2, those are development activities. We've included those as well.
Right. Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's the question?
I heard you in the report saying something about the $26 million check for the is that for the current developments that we have?
That's for current new construction.
Those
are in the pipeline that have been in the pipeline for years. For example, Lion Creek Crossing 5 is slated to close June 5th. Gratefully, it will release $7.5 million of held assets, and that will be a good thing. We have Lakeside Senior that is closing. We have 460 Grand that is coming. In closing, that is coming. So, we're going to have it, this very year. We have four things under construction. That's the most number of projects we've ever had. So, you know, it is kind of the perfect storm. I mean, the good news is we've got the resources if we're careful to weather it at this point.
So, let me ask you a question. Okay, for instance, if you have the 26 million. And you can write it. Does HUD place any stipulations on it? I mean, if you have the money to do the projects, what do? Because they say you.
They do a lot of stipulations, mostly related to affordability down the road. The funds we're using for the $26 million are first and foremost our replacement housing factor funds, which we were awarded when we converted the scattered sites to project-based Section 8. An odd thing in the rules is they give you eligibility to replace public housing units. But we have chosen and got approval through a request from HUD to replace them with project-based Section 8 units. So we're using that money. And then we have some MTW funds, because earlier on the board looked, we have a Fund 1 and a Fund 2 that was established for our development. Well, these are the monies we had available to put into development activities. And these are just all coming offline, but we've planned for these. So these are ones that we have held money in reserve to write these checks.
Okay.
Let's go Commissioner Castillo, and then we'll go back to you. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. So I'd like to say for the record that I stand behind our staff's determination to leave our families intact. And I know that that's going to be standing against a storm because the truth is that our families are faced with deeper cuts at the family level than we can possibly imagine. Cuts to CalWORKs, cuts to food stamps, medical is changing, and the families are going to be hit so much harder. So if we can, and I feel that that's what we're determined to do, to hold steady on their housing and not create circumstances where we impose more of a burden on them. I stand with you in that determination. I just want you to know that. The other thing is that concerning the $26 million, I have been here long enough, though a very short time, to know that development deals don't always work out the way that they're supposed to. So we're setting aside $26 million, and I know that in a development deal, there's funding that fluctuates, disappears, comes back, and the board is asked to put in more money, sometimes more money after that. Are we allowing for a cushion around that $26
million? We're not going to give anybody any. I would not at this point recognize any more money for anybody. We have made our commitments, and we made them a year ago in April at the retreat. And so far, every deal we have knows that that's the limit. If a deal doesn't go forward, then we could have more resources to, well, we could replenish some of our operating reserves would be the first thing. But you're right. They do fluctuate. These deals are solid in terms of we've done our final resolutions and we've done our final award.
So I believe during the last meeting you mentioned that on the table are also not making more development deals because it might be too expensive for us. But we are moving forward on everything that we have in place now.
Yes.
And none of that is going to be on the table for cutting.
At this point, we're not. Well, most of them are beyond the point of cutting. We've already done all the resolutions and contracts that we're moving forward with and prepared for any of the obligations that we have made as a board to the different limited partnerships and investment partners and the project-based Section 8 awards we've made, which are equally important because people have planned and have construction going on, and in the final closing we'll use those awards, and they got lending against those awards. So those are really important commitments as well. So anything the board has approved today, the funding, is in this budget. Okay.
So can I just add that this is the time we're coming in on schedule and on budget is really important because we don't have wiggle room.
Thank you very much. The other thing is, I think it's a really quick question. Can we pull from the Section 8 waiting list for our project-based folks?
Yes, we can, and I'm happy to report we already have talked about that internally. As soon as we exhaust our three-bedroom wait list, we will offer it to the tenant-based side prior to opening. So we've had those conversations, yes. That is a way that they could get housed quicker. You know, the one thing that's going to happen with the project-based wait list, though, sometimes people move in and within a year they want to transfer to the tenant-based program. It's always been, in some ways, for some families, a kind of shortcut under the tenant-based program, and it's something I've always been concerned about. We're not going to be issuing those vouchers, so this will be their one opportunity. And it's going to be, you know, till the end of 2016, 2017, until I think Michelle even dusts off that wait list.
Lastly, I just want to go with my vice chair, who said how incredible that the materials that we got today, they were very understandable. And they were just spelled out so well, and you did an excellent job going through the material, and I really want to commend you guys for putting this together for us. When I thought it might be a short meeting till I saw all of this, but you made it quite bite-sized, and I want to thank you for that.
You.
My last question, and then thank you, Chair. What I like to do during the year is to cross-check so that if we're handed something to vote on, I want to be able to go back and say, oh, yeah, there it is. And so is this the document that I would use to cross-check against any changes that come up next year or to say yes, the vote?
Yes, that's the approved.
Okay, thank you so much.
I would just want to add that we also have come before the board with our quarterly status report, which shows you budget to actuals. So it's even a more succinct document so that you can tell at the high level the categories, how it maps out to the budget versus the actual expenditures that have occurred.
I'm
going to
keep that one close.
Okay.
I actually just wanted to echo Commissioner Castillo there in saying that these were very well prepared and well presented and easily understandable. It was not the best budget report I've ever gotten because it wasn't very exciting as it has been in the past, but for a bad situation, it was done well. And also I want to appreciate you guys for it not being such a bad situation as it really could have been. So I really agree with the goals of the budget, also, just like Commissioner Castillo did. So thank you guys for all of your hard work.
Yes, Commissioner Nagaraj.
I had 2 points. One is a question, Janet, and this is a question I asked you previously, and it helped me frame very quickly the 20 million, the negative 20 million that mm-hmm. we see on page five. Mm-hmm. And the way that I see it is that that negative 20 is comprised largely of a negative 7 million for the MTW mm-hmm. budget line item, 3 million deficit in leased housing, 11 million in OPI, and 1.8 in local programming. Could you just spend 30 seconds on each of those five columns on just, you said it earlier, but just succinctly,
okay.
How that 20 million is made up of those five chunks.
Okay. So I'll start with OPI, which is column O, farthest to your right. That $11 million is our keeping in line with the investment that our executive director mentioned earlier. It's going to preserve those units so that we can lease them up, which is to meet our schedule, and so they will also generate cash flow. And so if you don't lease those up, then you have a problem on the backside because now you have units that are not going to be leasable in the community. So you have to spend that money to make money. In terms of leased housing, that includes the 2.5 million. Again, Executive Director Johnson talked about the new building next door, 1540 Webster, making our leased housing department centralized, all of the staff in one building, making our customer service to our residents better and more accessible because they will now have their own parking lot, et cetera. And so that $2.5 million is part of a commitment that the board has made to make that building come together. And then the $7 million for MTW. MTW covers every other deficit that we have in any other program. And so what you've done with your budget, if we have collapsed all of those expenses into one column because MTW pays for any deficits for any other program. And so that's what this budget reflects. And family and community partnerships, which, again, we don't show it here because it gets collapsed into the MTW column because that is our major funding source.
Thank you. Thank mm-hmm. you very much. That was really helpful when you went through that with me. And I do want to echo what was said earlier. I was fortunate enough to chair the Budget Committee, and Commissioner Hartwig served on it as well. And to reiterate something that Eric said, the sequestration and the federal cuts are drastic. And you know, the fact that we can maintain services to our existing tenants, Section 8 and public housing side, maintain the existing infrastructure, the actual physical maintenance of the buildings themselves. On the programmatic level, Commissioner Castillo brought up a great point that for the life of these families, they're experiencing cuts on a few different fronts, and a lot of it is the cut in state funding through services that are getting cut. And to be able to balance other hits that they might be experiencing through stable housing and a stable housing stock is a testament to conservative budgeting over the years and tireless advocacy from Executive Director Johnson and Janet Rice and the leadership here. So thank you very, very much for putting us in a position to be financially strong in really challenging times when we're hearing really, really rough stories about other public housing agencies and jurisdictions, cities and counties across the country. So it's we really, really applaud your work.
Thank you for your support.
Commissioner Pitts was just a nip ahead, so we'll get to you now.
Okay. All right, hello, thank you. Once again, well, on prior budgets, we've had our reserves outlined also, and I'm sure there's probably a strategic reason we don't on here, but I'm wondering if this puts us at risk of any of our reserves being captured or recaptured by HUD at all. How did we address that?
If you will look at that. There's a slide in here that identifies our reserves and how it's being reduced.
Okay.
Right now, based on my calculation,
there it is.
The projected amount, let's see, it's going to be just the red slide.
Yeah.
Looks like that.
Yep.
So
if you think about the size of our organization, and we've done a preliminary analysis based on the 39 MTW agencies are proposing a solution to HUD in terms of how to calculate our reserve, a reasonable reserve.
Right.
And right now, we are a half a billion dollar organization with only $11 million of reserve anticipated at the end of 14. To put that in context, our average monthly expenses are $18 million.
Okay. So you don't think we're at risk of getting this recaptured?
Less than 1 month? No.
I think we're at risk of not having of having HUD sweep things from locks if we leave it there. But
correct.
We are not going to leave it there this year.
Okay.
Because we're not going to have excess.
There's no excess reserves at this point. Unless something changes.
Right.
I think we're I think the good news is that we have things that we can postpone to make sure that it's not worse.
If HUD believes we have a lot of excess reserves, meaning unobligated reserves, the question is how you define it. And if they thought we had a lot of reserves, they could withhold funding us through locks.
Right.
Even though now the reserves are held in locks, if they see on our side, we have historical reserves that we've kept for the $26 million
right.
that we've got sitting here. They can say, well, look, they got $26 million sitting there. Let's not give them a half payment this month.
Right.
That's the danger. The fight that Janet was talking about, and we did this analysis in two ways, one with the OPEB, one without, to kind of the table that we had developed through the MTW program, you know, for that assessment tool. And if we do it with OPEB, we are in trouble
right.
if we don't postpone OPEB. We go down to $600,000 worth of operating reserves.
Holy cow.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
Very quickly, and I hate to ask for anything because this is so good, but I'm hoping that maybe one of my other commissioners would agree that it would be cool to have an acronym chart for the... Because I was writing down what they were, you were
okay.
saying...
There should be one.
Is that part of the footnote? Would that be good to put?
Please.
Okay.
I appreciate it.
Right. I wrote
thank
that down.
Yeah. Appreciate it.
I wrote that down.
Really noted. Thank you.
You call it acromania. Okay. Any more questions? Okay. I actually do have one.
Okay.
And I'm going back to the question that I think Adi was talking about earlier about the $20 million, the $20 million in the red here on the last page. So, and this is really a testing of understanding question. So if I look at OB and I see, call it a $12 million loss on OB, and it's my understanding that that's driven by capital expenditures, the rehab of OB units. So I see that would be approximately...
it's about 9.3.
10 million. I'll
yeah.
just call it 10 million.
It's 9.3.
Okay, so
yeah.
10 million. So if we didn't do that, now what I was surprised, I said, wait a minute, that still leaves us with about a $2 million loss. Now, are there other extraordinary items in that?
Part of it is income generated. So when you have units that aren't ready to rent,
that aren't online.
Online, you would lose
okay.
the income. So
okay.
it's
rental income.
Yeah, it's a double hit.
Mm-hmm.
I see. So what percent?
Now the triple hit is putting the Section 8 voucher on top of it that we have to pay for, and that's where I was mentioning if we get some units rehabbed and we want it
exactly.
to do it differently,
I understand.
We can generate revenue without having the cost on the Section 8 side.
Without having the admin cost on the
yeah.
Section 8
mm-hmm.
side, right. So approximately, so how many units are offline at any given point? Just give me a percentage of the total.
We're estimating.
Or it could be a number, I don't
well,
care.
Well, I can give you the current number.
That's a great number.
It's in the packet, I just have to pull it up. Right now.
Opie.
Right now we have units offline for renovation 249.
I see. 149. So that's a significant that's over.
And they're unrentable, I tell you.
So
you
that's like 15%.
We can't rent them if we don't have.
So that's like 15% of the
yeah.
units right now that are offline.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. Then the other one is if we go over to leased housing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I understand that. So there's 2.8 $5 million there of expenditures that I presume that's related to getting the building next door up and running, among other things, right?
Yeah, but mostly it's that, 2 points a month.
Right, right. So again, if I were to take that out of there, then I'm saying, oh, well, we're still at a $500 million loss there.
Mm-hmm.
So now...
The bottom line is to think of if we take our capital improvements out of this equation, mm-hmm. we're over $3 million in the hole.
Okay, that answers the question.
And if OPI can generate more than $3 million every year and MTW goes away, the more than $3 million are things that we can use for other purposes.
Yeah, because
and
that really...
the quicker we can get to that point, the better off we are.
Because that really goes back to the sequester hit.
Yeah.
Is where it really comes down to.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. So, very good. I have no more questions. I would just like to say that I've been on this board for a while. This is just awesome, what we're seeing here in terms of the evolution of the finance department, in terms of the quality of not just the data, but the quality of the communication has just really ascending every year. And you know, because you're talking to people, not everybody that's sitting up here has a background in finance, you know, and you are allowing everybody to understand something that is very complicated. And I applaud you for that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I'll move to approve the item.
Second.
And moved, seconded, and now we vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Those who abstain? Any nays? No. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioners. And I just want to add a thank you to the board, because if you had not done the work you had been doing since I've been here about getting this financial situation clearly articulated, we would not be able to have functioned this year in this budget. And I think that it's the groundwork. You know, when we started the budget committee, I thought, well, maybe we want to get someone who's never sat on it. But there were only a couple, and everybody has a pretty good knowledge. And I think it's a testament to having an experienced board that understands the agency, that can get through these troubled times. And I thank you and commend you for pushing us to make our accounting in a way that we can actually survive this storm. Thanks.
All right, so now we get to move on to item C, the consent agenda.
I'll second.
We have a motion, we have a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any abstentions? All those opposed? Carries unanimously. Beautiful.
Thank you, Commission.
Now where are we going? I'm shocked by the velocity that moved.
We are on.
No, we're moving to item seven.
Recognition of people who want to address the commission. There are no speaker cards.
There are no speaker cards, so therefore we're already going to written communications.
Written communications. You have two monthly reports in your packet, which your review were available to take any questions. I want to thank staff for pulling it together. I also want to thank particularly our asset management staff and our senior sites for getting us pictures and such detail in the report. I was really pleased with them this
fantastic time.
Yeah, it's a way we keep tabs on what's going on out there, and I really appreciate their work. In terms of the written communications, I just wanted to walk through a couple, and then I'll have some announcements. I've included a couple letters that we've signed on to, and one we did actually in-house on behalf of all these agencies and coordinated, because we're kind of dividing and conquered in the MTW side. They're worth a quick read, so you know some of the fights we're fighting that are very specific but very important toward our cause. I included a flyer for a home on 23rd Avenue. This was a youth-filled home. It's currently for sale for $135 from the Oakland Land Trust. I'm waiting for the flyer on the other one still. I didn't have it in time for the packet, and my regrets. I also updated just our monthly leasing activity, which gets back to both OPI and our Section 8, and I'll probably include it one more month until we're down to so little available that it seems purposeless. The other thing I wanted to remind everyone is on June 24th, we're having our annual meeting. According to our bylaws, our annual meeting starts at 7, and so I'm going to try and start it at 7, and I will tell you why in 2 seconds. And any other changes in the travel calendar. For just my general comments, I had a couple things I just wanted to point out. One thing is Jennifer and I, and actually Chief Duplessis and Patricia, all attended the Housing Development Law Institute conference in Washington, D.C. We're invited to present on the MOMS program, and I sat on a panel of the legal complications for MTW with attorneys never my favorite thing. No, it was actually really wonderful, and it was a terrific thing to be able to do. At lunch, they brought in one of the heads of the OIG for HUD, who talked about that year's assessments and where they're going for the OIG. It was worth the whole trip. So he put up a slide of which Patricia took a picture of, and then we got a PDF of it because everybody was very curious of what they're going to look at. And I just wanted to go down the list so you'd understand where they are and what's happening. Housing quality standards, they were looking at that. MTW moving to work. Those have both happened with us. We're done with those, so you know. Asset management. The asset management piece really has to do with trying to figure out if people actually have asset management departments. I think I need to look more into what they think they're looking at or what they think the complaint is. The other thing they're talking about is just executive director compensation, making sure that we go out and we get the surveys, and we are, and my salary is very much not in the middle range and in the Bay Area, let alone nationally where it's on the low range, and so I just want you all to know that, that it's an issue and it's a valid issue. When you have someone in Massachusetts who is overseeing a program, 1,400 vouchers, and paying himself $320,000 a year, and that is a true story. When you have someone in Los Angeles paying himself $640,000 a year, and that's a true story, they do need to look into it. And I just want you to know our position on it. In terms of us, they can look at anything. They are also looking at the use of outside attorneys because a lot of agencies, particularly most recently Philadelphia's annual legal costs were in excess of $6 million a year, which cover your head. We're very reasonable.
Well, Philadelphia
across the board.
Issues.
Contracts and procurement, which OIG has looked at when they were here for the 7 months with us. They're going to look at receiverships. They're curious why public housing authorities that have gone into federal receivership 20 years ago are still there. I applaud them on that one because I would wonder why they haven't been able to do it. But the last one I just really wanted to mention, they're going to look into an issue that's all over HUD and all over DC. It's about ethics and governance. And that really does impact the board. I'm on a committee that is with the HIGH group, the Housing Authority Insurance Group, that is trying to come up with an independent assessment similar to what we do with the police department, and where we go and they assess us and we end up being a CLOFA certified agency. So we're looking at those standards, and governance is one of those areas. But when they say governance, I just want to talk about a couple of things that he talked about that the OIG was looking at, so you would know where my view of the world. As of this spring, they're looking at things. Do we have our meetings regularly? Are they open to the public? Are they held in a place that is known? Do we post our agendas on the website? Do we pass our budgets on time? And then they're also looking, because of some other issues with some board members, particularly I think in the Southern California region, related to conflicts of interest with board members. So they are going to be looking closely at conflicts of interest. So I have made an extra effort with a couple of you to make sure that they're not there, to make sure that we know those boundaries. Along those lines, I've talked to Jennifer about developing our own conflict of interest policy for us so that we're really clear. I think that would help us give a safe harbor should any investigation or, you know, take place. So Jennifer's looking at that. There's some pretty good models out there, and we'll look at bringing that forward. And I think that's it. That's it for that one. Couple other things, the Brighter and Blight you got. This is moving forward. We will be sending out an invite for the 20th of June, which is the VIP night. We're going to have an outreach event for some providers next week to try and engage the people. I think it's going to be pretty extraordinary, and I hope I don't get too scandalous by my colleagues, because it's a very hard-hitting, honest look at what public housing has been, both good and bad. And I think we're strong enough to do this, is what I wanted to tell you.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be very healing for the neighborhood. And we've contacted a lot of the past families who lived in this development or grew up in this development, and the artist has interviewed them and talked to them, and they've been, KTOP is doing a video of the whole event, and they've been on camera, so it's going to be something completely different, and I'm out there with it, and I just appreciate your support, because it's something I think we need to do so that when CAHI decides they want to develop this lot, they've already done something good for the neighborhood. The other thing I wanted to announce, and they'll be in next month's packet, as I just got them today, is we have received 4 merit awards from NARO.
Yay.
and they are for the following: the Youth Bicycle Excursion Program, the Harrison Street Senior Housing Program, Housing Next Door, our Disaster Recovery, and our Get Fresh, Stay Healthy program at Lockwood. I am also pleased to announce that for the first time in my knowledge, we have received two Award of Excellent nominations for the National Awards of Excellent for the Harrison Street and for the Youth Bicycle Program. And I mean, I love the new development ones, but they always win. And if I can get youth on bicycles during the summer to get an Award of Excellence with COPS and yours truly, I'm there. Anyway, the last thing I got in the mail, if you want to go, it's going to be on June 30th, and they didn't have it last year, but they have this intimate evening and night in the park. I think it's the most wonderful thing the Rec and Parks does. They're our partner. If you want to go, please contact Inez when she returns from vacation this week, and we'll send this out electronically as well. And that concludes my report. But it's a lot of fun. I truly encourage you to get a ticket and let me know you're going, and we'll get a ticket for you because it's a great thing to do.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Johnson. And now we will move on to reports of commission committees. Did we have any commission committees meet this month? I don't.
Oh yeah, we had the education committee. And we had a really good meeting. We had the parent ambassadors there, and we learned a lot from them, right? Anita, Janet, and let's see. Oh, and that's it. That was it. I just wanted to make sure I covered everything. Yeah, so thank you. Thank you, ladies.
Okay, are there any announcements by commissioners? Okay.
Last week was Evo Housing Week. Mm-hmm. For I think some of our commissioners attended one or more of the events, and I think it's wonderful that we are part of that, in focused in the book, and also just being part of EPO is wonderful. There was on Wednesday there was an event that was geared to mental health and wellness and housing, something like that, and there was about 40 people in attendance. It was at the Pierce headquarters in Hagenberger, and I think that that's really a good thing to start talking about, because last month we were told that there were some landlords who were in need of more advice on how to work with, you know, our folks who are experiencing mental health issues. And I want you to know I took that request back to the Peers Housing Action Group. And who was present was Ollie Arnold from Eden INR, who just happened to be doing a Saturday at the Oakland Housing Authority. So I'm like, yay, because, you know, we can hook this up. So we literally was able to get one of the folks from Peers, a housing advocate, mental health advocate, to sit on a panel with our landlords, and she got so fired up because one of the attorneys said something that was she was really fired up after that. And she shared her story, and Ollie Arnold said that they changed some of the perceptions of the landlords, which is exactly what we want to do. And we also want to provide real help and real tools to help our people stay housed and to help our landlords want to house our people. So we're in conversation at that table how to provide even more support to Oakland Housing Authority. I'm hoping that the executive director would continue this conversation with Ollie Arnold from Eden INR. And she mentioned someone named
Tila Carpenter.
Tila Carpenter. Is she here? Hi, Ms. Carpenter. You were mentioned today. And so I really appreciate you helping Ollie, you know, put that together. Oh, she didn't think that she was even going to, like, sit in the corner back there. I'm like, hi. Yeah, no, but thank you for that, because it's so important.
This year, yes. That event was held here in the boardroom.
Yes.
And up on the third floor. We did have an elevator malfunction, which was no fault of those who put it on. And I thought the event was incredibly well attended and terrific. I was here in the morning. And Tila, you did a great job. And Michelle, you did a great job. And every year, it's, I think, well attended and well received by our owners. And you don't have to be a Section 8 owner to attend.
Thank you for that.
You certainly may.
Okay, the Berkeley Housing Authority gave an award to EBHO at its last meeting, and the person who came as a recipient to accept the award for EBHO was our own Commissioner Castillo. So that was exciting to see her in both places.
Hey, all right. Beautiful. All right, then our next step is, do we have a motion to adjourn to closed session?
I second
so done.
That. I second that emotion.
So done. We'll take 5 minutes.
Well done.
To chill. Oh, that's nice.